The biblical tension between madness and meaning is represented by contrasting the stories of the Tower of Babel and the upper room of Pentecost, the antitypes of Babylon and Jerusalem. The Hebrew Babel means the gate of God, and it refers to the place in the Genesis narrative where men try to make a name for themselves by building a tower to heaven. But the result of their efforts ended instead in Balal, a confused mixture of sounds and incomprehensible languages, and to the destruction of the tower. In the story of Pentecost, the Spirit descends upon the apostles in Jerusalem as tongues of fire that bridge linguistic divides. And people hear the apostles speaking of the mighty acts of God in their own tongues. The tension between madness and meaning is a perennial one. The prophet's role is ever to critique the madness and absurdities of an idolatrous Babel and point toward the peace of Jerusalem. From the Abbey of Gethsemane and from his hermitage on its grounds, Thomas Merton saw the world in the 1960s as a Babylon, characterized by dehumanizing political and economic systems, the violence of racial injustice, the escalation of war in Vietnam, the policy of mutually assured destruction with the ironic acronym of MAD, advanced by Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. "It's a mad, 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 mad world" was a blockbuster hit in 1963, and MAD magazine quadrupled its readership throughout the decade. In 1969, just after Merton's death, Richard Nixon would become president and describe his own foreign policy as madman theory. For Merton, the term madness carried specific reference to the dehumanizing conditions and idolatries of the modern world and to the resulting incoherence of its language. Merton's perspective on the madness of his world was framed by the biblical narrative and informed by the work of many of his contemporaries. In this paper, I want to explore how Merton's reading of Hannah Arendt and Michel Foucault sharpened his perception of Babel in the 1960s. I end by highlighting Merton's prophetic pointing to Christ, quietly present beneath the flashing distractions and clamoring voices of a covetous and arrogant Babel, as an alternative offering to his mad world and to our own. Hannah Arendt was already an established public intellectual when she volunteered in 1960 to cover the trial of the Nazi war criminal Adolf Eichmann for The New Yorker. She had studied in Berlin under the likes of Romano Guardini, the influential Catholic theologian, and the pivotal philosopher Martin Heidegger. Her doctoral dissertation focused on the concept of love in the works of St. Augustine, and she developed her political philosophy around his understanding of dilexio proximi, or love of neighbor. However, it was her work, The Origins of Totalitarianism, that established her as a keen analyst of society's ills. And The Human Condition, which followed, strengthened her reputation as an intellectual. The Origins of Totalitarianism focused, among other things, on the role of propaganda in producing what she called the ideal totalitarian subject. In Arendt's analysis, propaganda was not engineered primarily to convince people of official lies, but rather to confuse them so profoundly as to turn them into subjects who passively acquiesce to the dictates of the leader. She wrote, quote, "The ideal subject of totalitarian rule is not the convinced Nazi or the committed communist, but people for whom the distinction between fact and fiction and the distinction between true and false no longer exist," unquote. The public realm in such a state is characterized by distrust and fear, and this by insidious design. She wrote, quote, "In an ever-changing, incomprehensible world, the masses reach a point where they believe everything and nothing, think that everything is possible and that nothing is true," unquote. Confused and afraid, the masses seek protection and obedience to the leader, and obedience to the leader becomes the paramount virtue. Merton read The Origins of Totalitarianism and admired what he called its terrible insights. Arendt's characterization of the ideal subject of totalitarian rule parallels Merton's portrayals of Nazi war criminals in his poems from the 1960s. In a chant to be used in procession around a site with furnaces, Merton reconstructs the figure of an Auschwitz commander, Rudolf Hess, from Hess's own words recorded in the transcript of his 1947 trial in Nuremberg. "I was the commander. I made improvements and installed a guaranteed system, taking account of human weakness. I purified, and I remained decent. How I commanded and made soap, 12 pounds fat, 10 quarts water, 8 ounces to a pound of caustic soda, but it was hard to find any fat. All the while, I obeyed perfectly." The eye making the assertions is almost unrecognizably human, except for the detectable pride in the voice over his busyness and obedience. In Epitaph for a Public Servant in Memoriam Adolf Eichmann, published in 1967, Merton presents a man who can no longer think for himself, for whom the only virtue is obedience, whose only language is official orders. "The leader's success alone," wrote Merton, "proved that I should subordinate myself to such a man. Relations most normal. Who was I to have his own thoughts in such a matter, in such a transaction? Who was I to judge the master?" In his essay, Thomas Merton and Hannah Arendt, Contemplation After Eichmann, Karl Planck noted that the figure of Eichmann appears elusively in much of Merton's later writings as an antitype to the true contemplative. In Epitaph for a Public Servant, the Apostle Paul, a true contemplative, stands elusively behind Eichmann. St. Paul, ambitious for the higher gifts, puts away childish things and surrenders to mercy. Eichmann, who is content with his gift for truth as it, insofar as it depends upon myself, thinks that repentance is for little children and that becoming a man means acting not out of mercy. In the poem, "Repentance is for children and not out of mercy" are repeated throughout, revealing Eichmann's toxic notion of manhood, which stands in stark contrast to St. Paul's idea of what it means to put away childish things. In Merton's only published play, The Tower of Babel, Babel's inhabitants hold a trial to determine who is to blame for the destruction of the tower. Robert Dagge summarized it. "Words are first tried in court, but are acquitted because the people think that they will cease to exist if they stop talking. This is why silence is crucified in the end. Truth, propaganda, and falsehood are tried. Truth is found guilty and sent to the salt mines because he tells the people that they destroyed the tower. Propaganda blamed the religious warmongers, the clergy, the Freemasons, and the people liked hearing this, and propaganda was sent forth to form the minds of the young. Then falsehood took the stand and declared, 'The tower has never been destroyed because I have never been destroyed. And because I am everywhere, everywhere is the Tower of Babel.'" In 1963, Merton was reading about Eichmann's trial and discovered that, taken out of the context of the fascist Babel of Nazi Germany and placed on trial in Jerusalem, the genuine madness of Eichmann's world was unmasked. In part 5 of Conjectures of the Guilty Bystander, The Madman Runs to the East, it's full of Merton's tormented reactions to Arendt's coverage of the Eichmann trial, what he called her multiple indictment of our world. Though Eichmann had been found guilty and put to death, Merton was sure that the world would never be rid of him. He imagined Eichmann's last words, quote, "which he would have said explicitly if he'd known a human language of some sort," unquote, as declaring, "Your world is full of me. I am all over the place. I am legion." In his most direct commentary on the trial, A Devout Meditation on the Memory of Adolf Eichmann from Raids on the Unspeakable, Merton explains what bothered him most from Arendt's report, the pronouncement that Eichmann was perfectly sane. The psychiatrist who examined Eichmann found him to be an ordinary and dutiful man, not even anti-Semitic. Merton did not doubt Eichmann's sanity, but he was deeply troubled by it. He wrote, "The sanity of Eichmann is disturbing. We equate sanity with a sense of justice, with humaneness, with prudence, with the capacity to love and understand other people. we rely on the same people of the world to preserve it from madness. And now it begins to dawn on us that it is precisely the same ones who are the most dangerous? We can no longer assume that because a man is sane, he is therefore in his right mind. Perhaps we must say that in a society like ours, the worst insanity is to be totally sane. Unquote. For as impactful as Arendt's material on propaganda and on Eichmann had been for Merton, her work, The Human Condition, was perhaps even more so. He began reading The Human Condition in mid-May of 1960 and called it a cardinal book, a hinge on which one's whole thought can turn. In it, Arendt employed the tensions between private and public life and between contemplative and active life as hermeneutical tools to ground her judgments regarding the political landscape of the modern world, which she found imbalanced in the extreme. His journal recordings in early June of 1960 include several pages where he makes notes on her work. He finished her reading it on June 12th, and he made a list of all major points from her book. And the first three represent themes that are prominent in his writing in the 1960s. Number one, vita activa, the active life, has lost its point of reference in contemplation, thereby becoming purely active, namely degenerating from political action to fabrication to laboring, and finally to that completely empty task of job holding. Two, being has been replaced by process. The process is everything. Modern man sees only how to fit without friction into a productive process. And three, Cartesian doubt and Galileo's telescope have given man an Archimedean point from outside of the world and thus have alienated man from the world and from experience of the world. The Human Condition in Merton's reading described the correlation between modernization and dehumanization, stemming from the alienation of human activity from its contemplative ground. But it also deepened his appreciation for the public dimension of his monastic vocation. He wrote, "One of the chief personal conclusions I draw from this book is the Christian obligation to renew and recreate public life. Christianity needs to produce great," and excuse the gender-exclusive language, I'm quoting directly from Merton, "but needs to produce great men, not successful men, but great in understanding, self-sacrifice, forgiveness, men of tragic stature." Arendt inspired Merton to take his social responsibility more seriously, not in spite of the fact that he was a contemplative, but precisely because of it. The barrage of social essays that fired from his pen in the 1960s were triggered in part by reading her work. She helped him see the need for contemplative outreach to a world alienated and dehumanized by propaganda and doublespeak, and where evil had become banal. The work of Michel Foucault, on the other hand, though not as impactful as Arendt's had been for Merton, further informed his concern over the world's battle and helped him see that abusive power exercises a process of objectification, demonization, and scapegoating that destroys meaningful dialogue. As a gay young man living at a time when homosexuality was widely considered a mental illness, even in his own liberal France, Foucault was plagued by depression, suicidal ideations, and self-harming behavior. He was an outsider. Was he mad? Early in his studies, Foucault read an essay from Friedrich Nietzsche titled On the Use and Abuse of History for Life, which focused Foucault's entire academic career on examining the dynamics of power in the modern capitalist state. In his pivotal work, Madness and Civilization, Foucault traced the Western conception and treatment of madness from the late Middle Ages through the Renaissance to the Age of Reason. Foucault discovered that persons in the Middle Ages considered mad were valued in society as individuals who experienced and exposed the limits of reason and provided glimpses of the transcendent mystery. During the Renaissance and through the Age of Reason, however, madness ceased to be regarded as natural and integral to the broad scope of human experience, and it became the new leprosy. As José Barcelón, in his Introduction to Madness and Civilization, notes, in the middle of the 12th century, France had more than 2,000 leprosarians. However, as leprosy vanished, in part because of segregation, a void was created, and the moral values attached to the leper had to find a new scapegoat. Mental illness and unreason attracted the stigma to themselves. End quote. The Ship of Fools traveled the rivers during the Renaissance, and the asylums took the place of the leprosariums during the Age of Reason. Foucault's reading of the history of madness unmasked the sickness behind the so-called sanity that objectified and opposed madness as an enemy to be eradicated. Be careful who you choose as your enemy, said Nietzsche, because that's who you become most like. Merton had followed Foucault's writing throughout the 1960s, occasionally commenting in his journals about an article he had read by or about him, but a sustained engagement with Foucault's thought appears in his essay, War and the Crisis of Language, where Foucault's ideas inform the title itself and become the focus of section 7 of that piece. In Madness and Civilization, Foucault examined the discourse of early psychotherapy and showed how doctors would utilize the mental frameworks of the mad in order to manipulate their thought and behavior by creating what Foucault called a crisis of language. Since there was no reasoning with a madman, the doctor had to meet the patient on the patient's own terms. Foucault described the process, quote, for in the patient's insane words, there is a voice that speaks. It obeys its own grammar. It articulates a meaning. Grammar and meaning must be maintained by the doctor. The same language must continue to make itself understood. The doctor merely brings a new deductive element to the rigor of its discourse, leading to an eventual crisis by which the language is confronted by itself and forced to argue against the demands of its own truth. Unquote. To elucidate what he meant, Foucault told a story of a madman who believed that he was dead and would not eat. In order to get the patient to eat, the doctor presented him with a picture of a dead man eating. In Foucault's terms, he introduced the deductive element. And the patient accommodated himself to the idea that the dead do in fact eat, and so began to eat. Following Foucault's lead, Merton, in his article, finds it ironic and even humorous that the doctor, who accommodated himself to the madman's logic, began to share so much of his madness. Foucault's anecdote ends not with the patient believing that he is alive, but only believing that dead people eat, and the doctor believing that getting the madman to believe that dead people eat was some kind of improvement. Who's mad now? What Merton does in War and the Crisis of Language is flip the script so that he exposes the madness behind the so-called sane and reasonable world and directly confronts its battle. Unlike the doctor who attempts to create a crisis of language, Merton simply exposed it. His essay demonstrated that the powerful, whether it be the marketing madmen of Madison Avenue, who managed to sell a hairspray called a préjugé because it has what no other hairspray has, it has a préjugé, or the military madmen at the Pentagon who boast about creating a free zone in Vietnam by destroying all buildings and vegetation so as to, quote, prevent people from moving freely in that zone, end quote, speak a confusing and self-contradictory language. He is less concerned about advertisers manipulating consumers than he is about governments and military powers objectifying enemies and justifying wars through doublespeak and appeals to necessity. The fear of losing power compels those who have it to perceive others as threats, and threats become enemies. Merton writes, anyone who does not agree, who is outside the charmed circle of power, is wrong, is evil, is already in hell. Quote, the dialogue then proceeds in a way that reminds us of Foucault. Rational discourse with the enemy is useless. He does not understand rational discourse and makes negotiation an opportunity for lying. He has to cheat. Therefore, he has to be dealt with solely on the framework of his own madness and wickedness, his propensity to lie and cheat. To grant him reasonable conditions would be to treat a madman as a rational being, which would be the worst possible kind of mistake. Unquote. The insane enemy only understands punishment, and so must be punished, Merton writes. But the punishment must be shown to him in terms of his own madness. He must see that his own destructive violence leads inexorably to one consequence, his own annihilation. Unquote. The language of power of the war maker turns out to be nothing but battle, because it is self-enclosed in finality, Merton says. It does not invite reasonable dialogue. It uses language to silence dialogue, to block communication. When Merton wrote about madness in the 1960s, he was describing, in accord with Arendt, a collective alienation from the contemplative ground of creative action that leads to dehumanization and the desecration of language. He was describing, in accord with Foucault, destructive power relations and the destruction of meaningful dialogue by the objectification of those we dismiss and the demonization of those we fear. Are we any better off today? In Trump in a Post-Truth World, Ken Wilber describes what he calls our aperspectival madness that has turned the word truth into a euphemism for a power grab. He laments, quote, "There is no difference between fact and fiction, news or novels, data and fantasies. Everything handed to us by yesterday is not a real and enduring truth, just a fabricated fashion of history. It's our job to accept none of it, and instead only strive for a total self-created, self-initiated autonomy, which very soon becomes indistinguishable from nobody interferes with my narcissism." Wilber notes that in spite of the fact that critics like Habermas and Taylor were constantly pointing out, the deconstructionists don't seem to notice or care that they're committing the performative contradiction by asserting that there is no truth, except for their own universally true statement that there is no truth. Oh, the madness. Should we be surprised, then, by the way the current U.S. administration offers alternative facts and aggressively undermines the work of journalists with repeated allegations of fake news? Or by the way social media has been exploited by Russian operatives to float conspiracy theories like Pizzagate and spread misinformation and create confusion and distrust? It's easy to begin to feel as though citizens are being transformed into ideal subjects of the totalitarian state. Worn down by babble designed to make us line up, confused and afraid, behind the big man with the weapons on the wall, who will protect us from the Hondurans, the Mexicans, and the Iranians. In the 1960s, Merton ran like a madman to the east, but he stood his ground as a prophet. Babylon defines power in human terms as the capacity, as Merton says, to define how you think things ought to be and then to make them come out that way by cunning or by force. But Jerusalem, as an archetype of heaven, speaks of a divine power that appears in a fallen world as weakness. In his letter to Pablo Antonio Cuadra concerning giants, Merton rages against Gog and Magog, the Cold War superpowers of the United States and the Soviet Union, who are idolatrous of power and greed, and whose unmitigated arrogance toward the rest of the human race objectifies people of poorer lands as inferior and exploits them as proxies in their hotter wars against each other. The idols of Gog and Magog may differ, wrote Merton, but their madness is the same. They are the two faces of Janus looking inward and dividing with critical fury the polluted sanctuary of dehumanized man. The monk, however, points us not in the direction of the powerful giants, but to the poor, to the foreigner, to the stranger, to discover in unfamiliar accents the voice of the one we can trust. Merton wrote, "Christ is found not in the loud and the pompous declarations, but in the humble and fraternal dialogue. He is found less in a truth that is imposed than in a truth that is shared." Thank you.